This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. A former U.S. senator and a current U.S. congressman won their Republican primaries this week, as most everybody expected they would. One last-minute surprise, the farmer activist who came out against both, saying they don't understand what it takes to produce healthy food. So we'll take a closer look at that claim this hour. But the week's biggest surprise had nothing to do with Virginia's primary voters. Instead, it was the secret vote removing a popular president from Virginia's landmark university. Still hard to know just how Teresa Sullivan lost her job, although we're sure to understand a bit more soon, since the Washington Post reporter who's been digging into details is here with us. In addition to Anita Kumar, analysts Bob Roberts and Bob Gibson on hand too. So whether it's public office seeking or the mysteries of university boardrooms, your thoughts about anything Virginia political will be most welcome right after the news. I'm Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. You're having fun already, aren't you? Got thoughts about the firestorm of protest that seems to be growing in Charlottesville this week after word that the University of Virginia's president had been forced out of her job? Have any reaction to what voters had to say in this week's Virginia primary? Questions or comments about the kind of campaigning already going on in preparation for the general election that is still 5 months away? 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. That's 888-967-2825. Later in the hour, we'll speak with a Virginia farmer activist who made news with his surprise announcement just before primary day that he was endorsing two Tea Party activists because they best understood what farmers need. And still later, we'll check in with the former U.S. Chief Technology Officer, who's now back in his home state of Virginia, campaigning to get Barack Obama reelected. But we begin with our analysis A-team. Bob Roberts from James Madison University, Bob Gibson from the Sorensen Institute, and Anita Kumar of the Washington Post. Gang, welcome all.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Great to join you.
So, Anita, let's go to you first. Your paper has published several of your stories in recent days as you have tried to dig out details. So just what the heck is going on at your old alma mater at the University of Virginia?
Yes, it's funny how many people have who have looked me up from school to ask me the same question. Well, as many people know, the president was asked to resign, and she has submitted her resignation. The news came on Sunday. The Board of Visitors did not actually have a full meeting to discuss this, but there were some backroom conversations over a series of months, and the Board of Visitors has decided they had enough votes to ask her to leave. President Sullivan is very, very popular on campus and with the faculty and the students, and so this has taken everyone by surprise. Even the governor said he got a surprise call, and he's been very complimentary of her.
Okay, so we already have several questions and comments about this particular issue. The firing of Teresa, well, technically she resigned, but it was no question that she was forced to resign, Teresa Sullivan. Let's get to some of these, and anybody who wants to call us, we've got several phone lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK. This is Frank, who says, I read in the Washington Post that not just the faculty, but dozens of department heads, the provost, and the former president of UVA are all objecting to what this Board of Visitors did. So what's the chance that this mysterious secretive board could get fired and Dr. Sullivan could get her job back? Anita?
Well, I'm not sure that's how it works. I'm just not sure. It was startling to have her, departure in that way, dismissed in that way. It would be more startling to have her reinstated at this point, I think. But the Board of Visitors constantly changes, and it's actually later this month, July 1, really, a couple weeks from now, that four members of the board two are up for reappointment, so the governor, Governor McDonnell, could decide to reappoint them, but two have to come off the board because their term limited out. You can serve 2 4-year terms, and so the governor's office is giving no indication that this is a factor, and they're giving no indication of who they're appointing, but it's generally the way it works is that governors like to put in new people. Particularly, this governor is of a different party than the last one, so he's a Republican. He's more likely to have people leave that can leave and appoint new people. That's generally been his practice.
And Monday of the coming week, the board is expected to make a decision about an acting president?
Well, they've called a meeting, a closed meeting for Monday afternoon, in which they'll talk about candidates, interim president candidates. Unclear if they'd actually make the decision. I did speak to the rector earlier this week, and I think it was Monday, she said it would take 3 to 4 weeks to decide. So it's possible they wouldn't decide on Monday, but they'd just talk about it.
Well, I'm saddened that it is this situation that is causing us to next speak with this gentleman who is calling us from Charlottesville, because the fact of the matter is that we've been trying to get him on Virginia Insight here in our studios for the longest time to talk about the work that he does as a celebrated media professor. But Siva, thank you for calling, and please, and this may be why we haven't succeeded in getting you on the show yet. I'm still trying to figure out how to pronounce your last name.
Thanks, Tom. It's Vaidyanathan, and I'm the chair of the Department of Media Studies at the University of Virginia. And
you're calling because you have something you want to say about the situation with your university president.
Oh, I have so much to say. I have so much to say. Look, the faculty is united in its shock and dismay at this set of events and this action by the board. It's unprecedented. It is completely out of line with academic traditions and the best practices of any university. All we're asking for now is some sort of guidance and clarification, right? We want to know what kind of university we're working for. We want to know what kind of university we should look forward to. And I think the people of the state of Virginia are asking that question too. Just what exactly is the University of Virginia supposed to be like in the next 20, 50, 100 years? This board clearly made a decision, although it didn't actually have a vote, and I'm not even sure it conformed to state open meetings act to have this action, but the board clearly took a radical action to dismiss a president who only had a year in office with her team to exact her agenda by saying that it wanted to make a pretty significant change in how the university operates. Well, what exactly is that change? So we want to know two things. Number one, we want to know from the board, openly, honestly, what were the matters on which the president disagreed with the board that should totally be a matter of public discussion. It speaks to the future of the university much more than it speaks to the performance of the president herself. Because whoever serves as the next president is going to have to try to avoid getting fired. So we had better get a pretty clear idea of that. And that speaks to the second question we have. We want to know what sort of person should be the president of the University of Virginia, if not an esteemed scholar and teacher and leader with a sterling reputation and outstanding character like Teresa Sullivan. If someone as good as Teresa Sullivan isn't good enough to be president of the University of Virginia, then either we are in for a treat, because we're going to have the most awesome person in the world, or the board is just severely misguided in what they think the university can and should accomplish. So let's have an open public discussion.
Hold on just a second for me, if you would. I want to get some of our panel in on this discussion. Bob Gibson, I don't want to put you on the spot too much, because the Sorenson Institute is a part of the University of Virginia, and I suppose your job
Steve is doing a very good job. Okay,
so that was actually just what I was going to ask you is is what we're hearing from Siva what you've been hearing from other faculty and administrators?
Absolutely. People are shocked. People are absolutely upset. They do not understand the reasoning. They do not understand the broad general statement of philosophical differences. They really want answers. And I would ask Siva, were you surprised at all when former President John Castine suggested that she might come back?
Well, I think he was speaking wishfully more than anything. We all know that President Castine is one of the wisest and most experienced leaders in the state, inside or outside of the university. And I know that he cares more deeply for the university than just about anybody. So his wish that the board would take a much more deliberative and reserved approach to solving whatever difference there is with President Sullivan I think, speaks to the fact that this was reckless. In that sense, so when I read what President Castin said, I immediately thought, you know, here's a guy who knows how university business should be conducted. Here's a guy who understands the value of the university to the state. And here's a guy who has never been accused of acting recklessly. You know, he's a deeply thoughtful man. And so I think that comforted me, because I was so angry that I couldn't even trust my own judgment. I kept thinking, am I acting recklessly in response, right? I mean, I'm one of those faculty members, and I think it's just about all of us, who thought that Teresa Sullivan had installed in her short time in office a tremendous sense of optimism. She had gotten every stakeholder in the university, we thought, bought into her vision of the future. What we didn't count on was a handful of extremely wealthy alums who decided to hijack the process without openness, without honesty, without transparency. And that's what we're facing right now.
Siva, thank you so much for sharing that perspective with us. I apologize, but as you might imagine, we have a number of other listeners who also want to ask questions or make comments about this high-profile situation. As long as I have you on the line in public, though, I want to once again extend our invitation to get you on this show at some date in the future talking about your work completely separate from this controversy.
I would love to. I'm a fan of the show, and I apologize for not making time in my calendar to have this happen.
Yeah, I understand you're a little busy. But
you know what? Let's wait till the president's situation settles out, and I'll have a little bit more time for you.
Siva, thanks so much for making that call. Phone number here on Virginia Insight, 888-WMRA, talk 888-967-2825. Mostly right now we're talking about the controversy at the University of Virginia, but we'll get on to some other political things, Virginian, in a little bit. Kendra in Charlottesville, thank you for calling. Your question or comment for Bob Roberts, Bob Gibson, and or Anita Kumar, please.
Hi, this is Kendra.
Hi.
Am I on the air?
You are.
Yeah, my question was about the alumni that that have been referenced in Siva's remarks. There are all these stories in various newspapers, and there's even the full text of an email from the head of the Darden Foundation, in which he's talking about, I knew about this weeks ago, that, two important alums have contacted me about getting involved in the rector's little project, by which he appears to mean the ouster of the president. Does anybody have any idea who these alums are? Why? You know, how is it? What are the ethics of, you know, people who are unappointed, who have no accountability to the people of Virginia or the people of the university, getting involved in the ouster of our president?
Anita
Can
Kumar?
I answer that? This is Bob.
Oh, yeah, sure, Bob Gibson.
There is a debate going on at the University of Virginia about how public and how private the university is and should be. And there are people at the Darden Graduate School of Business who like their model of financing the university based on market forces and adapting to a new business model, which they view as acceptable and preferential for the university. I suspect, of course, there's lots of speculation, and no one knows exactly who these two outstanding, prominent alumni he is referring to might be, except I would suspect that they are major donors. I think there is some buy-in to the Darden entrepreneurial model of running the university as a business. I think that is very unpopular at the College of Arts and Sciences and many of the other schools. So there's a division here between folks on the Darden Foundation Board and folks in the College of Arts and Sciences who believe that a more traditional academic model of a public university is the one that has to be carried on.
Kendra, thank you so much for your call. In a moment, we're expecting to be talking with the Virginia farmer activist who took a surprise swing to the right a few days ago, announcing that for the first time ever he was endorsing candidates for Congress and Tea Party candidates at that. More with Joel Salatin when we get back from the break. But as always here, we are perfectly happy to travel in circles. So if by the time you get to the phone to respond to something you heard earlier, such as what we've been discussing about UVA, and we're moving on to something else, we're happy to go back. And we do have phone lines open for whatever you want to talk about at 888-WMRA-TALK. Joining us now by phone is a Virginia man who's been on the campaign trail himself for many years, campaigning for what he believes is a better kind of agriculture. But until last week, he had never before endorsed a candidate for Congress. That changed just a few days before Virginia primary day, when Joel Salatin announced that he was urging voters to support a Tea Party favorite in the U.S. Senate race and another Tea Party conservative in the 6th House of Representatives district. Joel Salatin, speaking to us from Polyface Farms in Augusta County. Joel, politics was never your thing before. Why now?
Well, because for the first time we had a couple of candidates. Well, I think the stakes are higher now with GMOs, Monsanto, mandatory radio frequency identification coming down the pike from the USDA. And I feel like sometimes like the noose is just getting tighter and tighter in the industrial food system. The corporate food is just insufferable, strangling. And for the first time, we had two legitimate candidates that were not, you know, third party. And I've supported third party stuff, you know, all the time, from Greens to Libertarians to whatever. But two real legitimate candidates who actually put in their platform a food sovereignty plank that they would actually support freedom of food choice for Americans. And that's the first time that's happened, and I just felt like, you know, the stakes are high and it's time to let folks know how much I appreciate somebody willing to take that stand.
So we ought to mention that the candidates that you endorsed in the 6th Congressional District, where Republican Bob Goodlatte is the incumbent, he was being challenged by a Tea Party favorite, Karen Kwiatkowski, and she lost, but you had endorsed her a few days before the primary vote this past Tuesday. And you also endorsed Jamie Radke, the former statewide Tea Party leader based out of Richmond, in her run for U.S. Senate against George Allen. She lost as well.
Yep.
Any upside or downside here for making these endorsements for these two people that nobody thought were going to win their elections anyway?
Well, you're right. Nobody thought they would win. But again, for me, it was more personal, and for the farm and for local food, for food choice. These two candidates, all I said in my endorsement, I said, if you think that I'm out in left or whatever.
Right field
left,
in this case?
Right. If you think I'm out, you know, over the edge here, all I ask you to do is call George Allen or Bob Goodlatte and ask them, do you think every Virginia citizen should have the right to buy raw milk from the person of their choice? And both of those campaigns would say absolutely not.
Okay.
And
this is
Karen,
Bob Roberts.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting... I mean, I went on your website and read your material.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the issue of raw milk, for example, that may listeners may not understand the history of milk processing, how the government has heavily regulated that for a long, long time for health and safety reasons, and the idea that raw milk can cause serious health problems. Why should the public believe that the experts who say that you need to take precautions, scientific precautions to safeguard the milk supply, that we don't need to do that?
Well, I'm not certainly endorsing not taking scientific precautions, but I am saying, look, it's time to join the 21st century. You know, we now have rural electrification, we have stainless steel, we have microscopes, we have 24-hour computerized temp thermometers. You know, we're not in the dark ages. We're not back in the 1920s with swill pits and brucellosis and still debating whether or not you should sanitize, scalpels between amputations. So we're in a totally different day. And in fact, in that day, nobody was getting sick from grass-based milk. The milk that was hurting people was milk that was being fed the distillers' grains from the brew houses that were also in the urban sector. What happened was the urban sector was growing much faster than the understanding, infrastructure, or logistics to metabolize the urban development at that time. I mean, we didn't even have polyethylene plastic pipe. We didn't have indoor plumbing. And so there was a confluence of urbanization without now the hygiene and infrastructure to metabolize that urbanization.
Joel Salatin from Polyface Farms, a longtime organic farmer activist. Part of your fight, Joel, as I understand it, for a long time has been against big corporate agribusiness. Is part of what you're saying and the point you were trying to make in these endorsements of these two Tea Party candidates is you have a sense that corporate agribusiness has taken over government regulation, that that they have too much influence with the FDA and the USDA?
Oh, absolutely. Anybody who's seen Food, Inc., I think the strongest point of that, whatever it was, Grammy-nominated, I don't know what all those awards are, but anyway, documentary, was the part at the end where they did the business cards and flip-flopped them between the USDA and Monsanto and the FDA and Monsanto. I mean, even President Obama has named Michael Taylor, the former attorney for Monsanto for 10 years who brought genetically modified organisms to the world, as his czar of food safety at the FDA. And so, you know, here we have a culture that says it's perfectly fine to feed your kids Twinkies, Cocoa Puffs, and Mountain Dew. But, compost-grown tomatoes, raw milk, backyard chickens, those are hazardous to your health. And I think the corporate side thinks that our side is stuck in the, you know, in 1900 when, you know, we have electric fences and we have refrigerators and freezers and stainless steel and real-time temp thermometers and things like that. And so, we're not in the 1900s, and we can be thankful that our technology has allowed us to actually have a much more nutritious, ecological natural product without the diseases that were occurring in the early days of industrialization.
Joel Salatin, president of Polyface Farms, based in Augusta County. His newest book, by the way, is titled Folks, This Ain't Normal. Joel, so good to talk to you. Thanks for making time for us. And we are going to get you here in our studio sometime in the next few weeks to talk about this new book of yours and to talk food, not politics, okay?
Wonderful. That'd be great. I'd be honored. Thank you.
Thank you. Phone number, if you have anything to say about anything political, including what's going on with what apparently has become viewed as a political situation at the University of Virginia that we were discussing earlier, our phone number, 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. Whether it's food, whether it's university politics, whether it's presidential politics, the recent primary, our analysis panel here to talk to you, Anita Kumar of The Washington Post, Bob Gibson from the Sorensen Institute, and Bob Roberts from the Politics, well, actually, I guess it's called Political Science Department at James Madison University. Sometime, Bob, we'll talk about the controversy about those who say it's a politics department and who say it's political science. But this probably isn't the time because we got all these posts on Facebook about University of Virginia. Right. Here's Ron, who says, no one knows what actually happened because this was a stealth coup by a power-hungry select group within the board of UVA, thinking that this vulture corporate style they want to press on UVA is the way to go. Not. Of course, they have their own little puppet to replace her in mind. End quote from Ron. Anita, is that kind of response something that you've been hearing, or has it been more measured than that?
I've been hearing that over and over again all week. I mean, there are people that are obviously upset with her, President Sullivan's departure, but beyond that, people think that why has the Board of Visitors not been more open and talked about the reasons for her departure? And there's the issue of, you know, it was raised earlier today, there was the issue of how it came about, where they didn't actually have a meeting to vote on this. It was, all done sort of privately behind closed doors. So, yes, I've been hearing those things all week.
So I'm hoping you're going to forgive me for this because I'm going to read a little bit from another newspaper's story.
All right.
This is the Richmond Times-Dispatch earlier this week that quoted Peter Kiernan, who's chairman of the Darden School Foundation Board of Trustees, who was one of the few people early on to make any kind of public comment, supporting the decision to force President Teresa Sullivan out of her job at the University of Virginia. And the Times-Dispatch in this story a couple of days ago says, trust me, Helen has things well in hand. Helen referring to the board rector who made the announcement that Sullivan's resignation had been accepted. Also notes that Mr. Kiernan is a former partner in Goldman Sachs, Bob Roberts, does that kind of connection with Wall Street, let alone coming from the graduate business school, sort of fuel these ideas that this is big money trying to take over?
I think it fuels what we have to understand, that universities right now across the country are under extreme pressure. They're being cut off from state funding. They're being told to take care of their own finances. They're in facing serious dilemmas. And this board, which is primarily a business board, if you look at the members of the board, go down the list, who they are, come from a business background. And as Bob Gibson was stressing, they seem to believe that the university has to make a transition to a heavily business model.
And you, looking at the memo that's right. been released,
right.
that well, I guess it's time to call her former president,
right.
Teresa Sullivan at the University of Virginia,
mm-hmm.
Put together to say, this is what my strategic
right.
plan is for the future.
Right.
Looking at that, you think the board may have had good reason
I thought the board, from the board's perspective, that memo didn't do what they wanted her to do. I'm not saying I endorsed what the board did. That's not the case. What I'm saying is, if the board wanted a business model, that memo didn't give them a business model. And so that's very different. In other words, they want apparently a university operating much more like a corporation or a business than an academic institution. And that memo was a defense of an academic institution. We'll reform the academic institution, but this primarily is an academic institution. It is not going to become a business model. And apparently the board believes, rightly or wrongly, that the university cannot survive unless it adopts a business model. And I think that's the crux of the debate. How can any institution of public higher learning survive in this economic environment where we are not getting funded by the state, where tuition cannot keep going up the way they're going up because students cannot be burdened with the debt? How can these institutions survive? And so I think this is what the dilemma is. The board is fighting with the former president over that.
Bob Gibson, you lead the Sorensen Institute, which has as its mission getting people with different points of view, especially different political points of view, talking to each other and appreciating each other and bringing down the hostility and the shouting that we see in the way politics is usually portrayed these days, and actually getting some sense of understanding where each other is coming from. Is that a fair summation
because
Sorensen does?
People in politics can learn a great deal from each other if they'll talk to each other, sure.
Okay, so let me put you on the spot, since that's your specialty. Based on this firestorm of protest, is it reasonable to say that the Board of Visitors has not been handling this thing well? And if it is true that it's not been handling this well, is it reasonable to have some questions about their competence to be making the decisions that they are making about UVA's future?
Let me answer as a 34-year former journalist instead of a Sorensen Institute person. And in my experience covering Virginia's government and politics for 34 years, this was not handled well because they did it entirely too secretly. They did it without buy-in from the faculty. Every time there's been a change in the presidency previously, there's been buy-in from the faculty. The faculty was blindsided. I talked to members who had recently been on the Board of Visitors. They were blindsided. The alumni were blindsided, at least unless they were part of this small group in this project. A lot of people have a great deal of affection and more for the University of Virginia, and they feel left out of the process completely. And we are still a public university.
Correct.
And we have certain norms of governance the Board of Visitors, when I was a student here back in the 60s and 70s, met entirely in private. Their meetings were exempt from the Open Meetings Act, and they conducted them in private. And the Cavalier Daily, the newspaper of record at the university, the student newspaper, put a microphone under the board's table one day and recorded a meeting, and it was a scandal. The microphone fell off the table and was discovered. there's too long a tradition of doing too much of the board's business behind closed doors. And if they're going to change a business model at the university, they have to do it with faculty buy-in, and they have to do it with other buy-in, and they have to do it in public.
And Bob's absolutely correct. If you're going to make such a dramatic change in how an institution is run, and universities are doing this across the country, you need to have transparency in doing that. You need to go to the various constituents and saying, we have no choice. You need to defend the policy. You need to say that this is not, you know, we're not going to do it in the dark of the night. We're going to do it openly. We're going to explain why we're going to do it. Not this way. And they may sincerely believe this is the only way for the institution to survive. But if they believe that, they need to sell it. Because otherwise, you rip the institution apart. I mean, you really can destroy an institution by engaging this behind the scenes. And an academic institution is supposed to be teaching us how to be open, how to be democratic, particularly public institutions, and they didn't do it.
Okay, let me just note for anybody who's just joined us, speaking to us from the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities in Charlottesville, the man who heads up the Sorenson Institute, Bob Gibson. Speaking to us by phone from the Richmond Bureau of the Washington Post, political reporter Anita Kumar, and here with me in our Insight Studios in Harrisonburg, James Madison University politics professor Bob Roberts. Anita, I understand we have some breaking news there.
We do. The Faculty Senate at UVA had met in a sort of an emergency session this afternoon, and they passed and unanimously adopted a resolution. It's very brief. It says two things, that they express that the Faculty Senate expresses its strong support of President Sullivan and expresses its lack of confidence in the rector, the vice rector, and the Board of Visitors. That's it.
We have several long posts that we won't be able to read all of, all of them objecting to how the situation was handled and supporting outgoing President Teresa Sullivan at the University of Virginia. So anybody who wants to read them in total is welcome to go to our Facebook page, which is listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight on Facebook. And if you have a Facebook account, you're welcome to go there and post a comment or question of your own, or to call us at 888-WMRA-TALK. But let me read a little bit of what Professor Valerie Cooper from the Religious Studies Department at UVA had to say. Quote, as a faculty member, I was absolutely floored by Sunday's announcement of President Sullivan's resignation. Like most of the faculty and broader University of Virginia community, I was blindsided by the resignation. However, since my stunned and cautious response to the initial announcement, my reaction has changed from surprise to anger as the Board of Visitors has failed to explain its actions adequately. I'm very grateful to the work of the independent press, from local papers like the Daily Progress and The Hook, to national publications like the Washington Post and the New York Times, which has uncovered suggestions that removing President Sullivan was not the desire of the entire board, but perhaps only a few powerful alumni. Is that, Anita, a fair summation of what the press has been finding?
you should read a story that we're having tomorrow, but okay. Apparently it wasn't quite as unanimous as we were led to believe. And as others were led to believe.
You're going to make us wait.
Perhaps it was unanimous among the people who counted.
So we're all going to have to get our copies of the Washington Post early tomorrow. But actually, we're changing topics to national politics in just a moment when we have a former member of the Obama administration join us. Now on the phone line with us, the man who left his job as Virginia's Secretary of Technology a few years back in order to join the Obama administration as America's first ever Chief Technology Officer. Then, a few weeks ago, he resigned his post in Washington amid much speculation that he was preparing to run for statewide office back here in his home state of Virginia. No official announcement on that yet, but Anish Chopra is spending much of his time these days campaigning for the re-election of his most recent boss, the current occupant of the White House. Anish Chopra, welcome to Virginia Insight.
Well, thank you for having me.
So why should Barack Obama be re-elected, and what are the chances that the majority of Virginia voters are going to agree with you come Election Day are, I think, the two key questions we want you to address.
Well, the most important reason for re-electing the president is to build on the momentum we have so that our economy, not just in the next year or two, but for the next decade and beyond, is on much more solid footing for this generation and the next. The president inherited one of the worst economic recessions and immediately went to action. The Recovery Act went into effect within months of the president taking office, and we've seen a fairly significant trajectory in private sector job growth. And while those numbers are important to review, even more important has been the president's investments in the long-term investments for America's future, what we refer to as the building blocks of American innovation, continued investments in research and development to create the jobs and industries of the future, the focus on ensuring we have the right rules of the road to focus on innovation and entrepreneurship, which has been a big job creator over the last several decades.
Mr. Chopra, I have to stop you for just a second because I'm sure everybody listening is curious about this. It sounds a little bit like you're in the midst of a convention right now. We forgot to ask, where did we reach you? I guess we reached you on a cell phone, but where are you?
I am addressing the U.S. Conference on Mayors, where the mayors just announced a bold initiative to promote innovation and entrepreneurship, very much aligned with the president's open government philosophy. And so unanimously, the body just endorsed a whole body of initiatives, bringing the open government philosophy the president brought to Washington to every community in America. And
so what we're hearing there are mayors talking in the background.
Well, or their staffs and the folks that are here at the event.
Anish, you were known in your time in Richmond as Secretary of Technology for the Kane administration as a very personable guy, a very bright guy. I don't mean to insult you, but you do sound at this moment like you're reading from a script, like you're telling
well,
us the party
tell
line.
Your mind.
So let me ask you the question a little bit differently then.
Sure.
If you could, in that sort of personable, your own words way. You know that Virginia is going to be a battleground state, and it could swing, according to the polls at this point, either way, for Republican side or Democratic side come November in the presidential race. What is it that's going to bring Virginians to support your guy?
Well, to me, it's pretty straightforward. There's a pretty big judgment that the voters are going to look at over the next several months, and that decision is, are we going to take the experiences of the last 5 to 10 years and take the following lesson that are we going to go back to a set of ideas that have taken us to what brought us to this point today, or are we going to take a step forward and say what we need to do for the next decade is ensure that we have an economy that's built for our next generation. If you think
okay,
about,
I'm going to stop you right there.
Yeah.
Because I want Bob Roberts, Bob Gibson, and Anita Kumar are our analysis panel. Bob Roberts has been analyzing politicians and politics and public policy for more years than he can count. I want to ask you, is what we're hearing from Mr. Chopra a matter of trying to get the electorate to say, hey, do we want to go back to the Bush years or we want the guy that we currently have? Is that what you think the Obama campaign is going to try and do?
The Obama campaign has really one choice. With unemployment the where it is and the economy as slow as it is, it has to convince voters that they're better off with the Obama plan as articulated here versus going to a radically different plan. And that's the simple – voters are going to have a simple choice to make. Are they willing to stick with some like Roosevelt in 36 when the economy wasn't doing that well? Were they willing to stick with Roosevelt rather than going back? And Obama is basically saying the same thing that Roosevelt said in 36. We're a lot better off than we were in 32, and Obama is saying we're a lot better off than we were in 2008. Things are going to get better. They may not be great. They weren't great in 36. But if you go to the other side, it's going to be a lot worse. And so it's not as if we've accomplished everything we thought we were going to accomplish. It's that things could get a lot worse if you change horses in the middle of the stream. And that's a very simple simple articulation of what Obama's trying to do.
Anita Kumar with The Washington Post. I know you love it so much when I do this with absolutely no warning ahead of time that I was going to do it. So I thought I'd try again to ask you but I know that you know Anish Chopra.
Do you
have any questions for him?
Well, I was going to switch it up a little bit. I know we're talking about 2012, but you know, Anish, that I like to talk about 2013. I thought you were going to announce your bid for lieutenant governor already. Why have we not seen that?
You're very kind. We have a very important election ahead of us in 2012, though it is deeply important for the country that our president be given another 4 years to continue the job he's done and to build on progress. I feel the same way about Governor Kane. The Senate's going to take up some big issues in the next couple of years, and obviously Governor Kane has the right posture to figure out how we strike the balance between growth and debt reduction, and that is going to be a very important part of the discussion over the next several years.
Okay, Anish Chopra, I have to follow up because we've got you on the phone for less than 60 seconds more. Are you going to be a candidate for lieutenant governor in Virginia next year?
Haven't made that final decision yet, but you can obviously imagine it's been something that's been on the mind.
So you are definitely considering it, and you'll let us know.
Absolutely. But listen, we've got a lot of work to do in Virginia, and it starts with getting the right decisions for this fall's election. Then we have a wonderful talk about how Virginia will invent the next chapter in American democracy, and we can have that conversation for next year.
Looking forward to it. Anish Chopra, the first ever U.S. Chief Technology Officer, now, as you can tell, back in Virginia, campaigning hard to get his old boss reelected. Anish, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
So we still have here on our panel Anita Kumar from The Washington Post, Bob Gibson from the Sorensen Institute, and Bob Roberts from James Madison University, available to talk about anything and everything related to current events, especially if it has a political connection. And suddenly we have all of our phone lines open at 888-WMRA, talk 888-967-2825. Hey, Bob Gibson, as that longtime former political reporter person, do you have any reaction to this week's primary?
I think it proves that redistricting was very effective for incumbents. There were several members of the House of Representatives who were easily renominated for their current seats, and each of the 11 districts in the state is probably a bit stronger for the person's party who occupies the seat, thanks to redistricting that was largely carried out with the incumbents shifting the lines around so that the D's gave a few more votes to the R's from their districts, and the R's gave a few more Democrats to the Democratic congressman, if they could. And I think it showed that George Allen is the best known of the four candidates who ran in the Republican primary for U.S. Senate, and that we've already had a year and a half of an Allen-Kane race. Now it's official.
Bob Roberts, you live in his district, so let me check with you about this race with Bob Goodlatte and Karen Kwiatkowski, if I'm pronouncing right. The name close to correctly. He beat her in the primary. I think it's the first ever primary he's faced.
Right.
He's now seemingly assured a 10th term because he always wins the general
election.
He'll
be running against Andy Smukler, who's the Democrats have nominated.
And we don't have anything against Andy, but as Bob Gibson just mentioned, Goodlatte's district is carved and districted in such a way that it's overwhelmingly Republican.
Overwhelmingly Republican.
And he has won every time by an overwhelming majority.
And he'll win this by an overwhelming number. Majority.
What's the significance, even though he won his primary by 2-1, what's the significance that more than 10,000 people in his district came out on primary day to vote against him?
Not very much significance, because the turnout was so miserably low that, in a sense, it showed that even 10,000 people, that's not a lot of angry voters.
Is it going to affect, though, how he and maybe some other Republican members of Congress who worried about attacks from the right wing of their party in the future are going to behave once they're in Washington, being extra concerned to stay looking as conservative as possible?
Goodlatte is as conservative as possible. So the whole idea that anyone would come after him from the right didn't make any sense, because that was an amazing thing about someone coming after him, because he is one of the most conservative members of Congress already. And therefore, why go after him? And the reason they went after him was they thought he'd been there too long. It was resurrecting the whole term limit issue that came up in the early 90s. And that has died. The whole idea that term limits are valuable has long lost the political support, and therefore that's why the challenge against them didn't work.
Hey, Anita Kumar at The Washington Post. Big news this week that Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli, the Ken Cuccinelli. God, I'm having trouble with names today. Our state attorney general has now endorsed George Allen for U.S. Senate, something he declined to do before the primary election was over.
Is that big news? He waited until...
after the primary.
Yeah, the attorney general waited until the day after the primary to endorse George Allen. It was pretty much a fait accompli, as we were saying before, that he was going to win. But he decided to stay out of... He also stayed out of the presidential race, although he now supports Mitt Romney.
And the reasoning there is, I make sure that I don't offend anybody on the far right?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I guess so. I mean, I'm not sure that he was, you know, George Allen was really his favorite. I don't know that Mitt Romney was really his favorite. But, you know, he has said that he would endorse and support and work for the candidate, you know, the nominees, and he's going to do that. But, you know, everybody was begging him for his endorsement in the Senate race, and I thought he probably thought it was safer to stick it out, but stay out of it. But, you know, remember, he's also running for election already, so for next year, and so you don't want to annoy people on either side when you're running yourself. So
he's trying to get the Republican nomination to run for governor next year.
Correct.
Against the current longtime lieutenant governor, Bill Bowling. Something happening this week that's likely to influence who gets that nomination?
Yes, a big meeting tomorrow. It's very insiderish, but it actually has a very big impact on the race. The Republican Party's governing board is meeting tomorrow. That's 81 people from around the state, and they're going to decide whether the party should hold a primary next year or a convention. And the attorney general wants a convention, and the lieutenant governor wants a primary. So they're fighting about that. If it goes to a convention, which a lot of people think that the attorney general is going to win, they think he has a very, very good chance of winning the nomination.
Bob Gibson, remind us why a convention is better usually in the Republican Party for the more conservative candidate.
Well, you're packing thousands of individuals for an entire day or a good part of a day into a large room. And the hardcore activists in the party are the ones who stick around the longest. So they're willing to stay and fight and believe in their, you know, press their views. So the base tends to turn out more for conventions, and the base is not large enough in some cases, if it's a large turnout primary, to control a primary. So there's less risk, I think, for a conservative in a convention.
Will Bowling sue, Anita? And in other words, will he go to court?
They're looking at it. The lieutenant governor has hired a Washington lawyer who's very big on election law, and they've been researching their options. I do hear from the Bowling camp that they feel like there hasn't been a time in the past where a judge has allowed the party to switch the nomination method. So what happened here?
So have we? Yeah,
yeah.
Have we
underscored
this?
They
already decided.
The Bowling felt that he had a deal.
Right.
That the Republican Party bosses across the state had decided that they were going to have a primary.
Yes.
Which Bowling stood a much better chance of winning.
Yes.
And then many of those boss jobs at the local level changed, and suddenly the new guys decided, no, we want to talk about a convention.
Yeah, a lot of very conservative Ron Paul supporters won for a variety of reasons. Some of them are Cuccinelli supporters. Some of them are, you know, the Ron Paul supporters that are trying to get on to different places all in states across the nation. So it's a lot of different factors, but the bottom line is they all prefer a convention. So it's widely assumed that Cuccinelli supporters are going to win tomorrow. Lieutenant Governor has not ruled out filing a lawsuit. I would not put it past him if it goes the other way.
Would he go to federal court or state court?
I'm not sure. What, wouldn't it be state court?
I'm just wondering whether this implicates the Voting Rights Act at all. In other words, the changing the primary system, which
I don't know the answer to that. But you know, one of the things that I think we just talked about that he's been saying in recent days is that this impacts military voters.
Right, that's what he's been saying.
Right, and so that is a factor. Those who are stationed elsewhere or overseas, they would not get to vote if it's a convention because they couldn't come to the convention.
And I thought he was setting that up as a possible legal grounds.
Yeah.
In other words, you're disenfranchising a large number of voters who had been almost guaranteed that they
right.
could, and you're taking away a right that they already had.
Right, right.
Anita, we've only got 30 seconds left before the show ends.
Yes.
Give us just a little more of a hint about what's coming out in your story tomorrow that you can't give us the full details about.
Well, you were correct, and several people have told us that it was not a unanimous decision. Although, and you've heard some rumblings about that, but you know
to the University of Virginia.
Yes. Oh, sorry. When I talked to the rector the other day, she said it was overwhelming. The governor's office was told it was unanimous. It turns out it wasn't unanimous, and actually, some board members were purposely kept out of the loop.
I'm getting up early to read you online. Our guests have been from the Charlottesville studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, the director of the University of Virginia's Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, Bob Gibson, plus professor of politics and public policy from James Madison University, Bob Roberts, and with us by phone, Washington Post political reporter and Charlottesville native, Anita Kumar, as well as earlier in the program, Virginia Democratic Party activist and former chief technology officer to the Obama administration, Anish Chopra, as well as Augusta County-based farmer activist Joel Salatin, whose newest book, by the way, is titled Folks, This Ain't Normal. Thank you all so much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And if you go to that page, you will find links to more information about all of our guests, because I know you'd like to know more. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.